Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, friends, buddies, companions, soulmates, allies, partners, sounding boards, pals, mates, sidekicks, wingmen, and wingwomen. Yes, there are a lot of different types of friends. And we're here today to explore friendship and celebrate how all of these types of friends are necessary, because we're going to talk about Tomás Moniz's new novel, All Friends Are Necessary. I'm Grant Faulkner, your podcasting and writing friend, or I hope I am. And I'm here with my good friend, Brooke Warner. And Brooke, when I think about my life, I sometimes think my friends have shaped me more than anyone else, you know, even more than my romantic partners, more than my family even. I think that's in part because I'm just a creature of friends, to the point that my daily rhythm is a matter of being in touch with just a bunch of people throughout the day. You know, I'm never truly alone, even though I actually do like to be alone. And so I have a hunch that we're similar. So I'm curious what role friendships have played in your life.
Yeah, very similar. I have a lot of friends, lots of friends from early in my life. And I would say, same as you, like friends have been a constant and a big influence, a through line. I'm a person who proactively reaches out to my friends, needs my friends, cultivates friendships, you know, all of that stuff. So I'm very aware of the essential role that friendship plays in my life.
Yeah, you know, I often say that my friends essentially were my education, and especially early on, I didn't go to the best high school academically. And in fact, it was really a joke. So my friends and I, we actually skipped class and we drove around literally for hours, you know, listening to music and talking, but not just talking, because we talked about ideas and books, and we'd sometimes swing by the college library in town and hide away there. And we were always looking for new, different music. So we got into punk rock and Philip Glass and odd classical music. And then when I went to college, I experienced a kind of variation on that theme. You know, my classes were academically challenging, but it was the late night discussions and debates that really shaped my thinking and myself as a person. That's what I really remember. And that was the education that has mattered most to me and still matters to me, because I feel like my friends are always introducing me to new things in life, and I would just be such a paltry person without them. And that's one reason I'm drawn to Tomás Moniz, because his first novel was called Big Familia, and his new one is All Friends Are Necessary. So I kind of conflate the two and think of a big familia of friends, which is my life more or less. And I am, as you know, always intrigued by how novels tend to focus more on, you know, things like romance and marriage and family relations, even though friendship is such a dominant force in our lives. And I'll take that even one step further. When I think of friendship novels, they tend to be by and about women, not men, which I find interesting. Or the friendship novels about men come with quotation marks, because the friendship is often about the shared activity or pursuit. You know, it's almost like a battle war story, I think. And I remember you love The Tender Bar because of the male mentors who essentially raised J.R. Moringer, and he wrote a memoir about that.
That's true. I do love that book. You know, the men who take my memoir classes are often looking for books that feature men's stories in whatever shape. You know, friendship could be part of it, but it really any. And there are many, of course, male memoirs. But The Tender Bar is a great guy's story because of the male dynamics in the book. But it's actually largely centered on JR and his mom also. Hmm. You know, a couple other memoirs that came to mind. K.S.A. Lehman's memoir, Heavy, is a book that really centers friendship, you know, its influence on him, how his friends help him, his circle of friends and their struggles, but also some of the shitty ways they treated each other growing up. which is, of course, part of being in friendship circles. Hua Su, his book, Stay True, which is, he is on my guest wish list. So stay tuned in the future. We'll try to get him on. That's a beautiful memoir about losing a friend young, and it explores friendship as an essential human need. So, you know, the memoirs are definitely out there. I also got to thinking that maybe it's easier to find books in the nonfiction stacks about friendship. And my good friend, Mark Nepo, has a new book coming out this summer. So maybe we can bring him back on the show as well. And that's called You Don't Have to Do It Alone, The Power of Friendship. And it's a beautiful book about friendship, you know, how we need each other, how we lean into friendship. But he's made the point to me lots of times, I mean, both personally and in his teaching, he's said it too, that too few people reach out to their friends, you know, like people tend to self-isolate. Never has that been more true since the pandemic, and that we need to exercise that friendship muscle a bit. And it's a vulnerable thing to do. And sometimes I think women are just encouraged to do that more than men are. I did look at some novels, and I want to ask you, Grant, I mean, I actually had to look up the Guardian, you know, list, like they had the top 10 stories of male friendship. A few of them stood out to me because either I've read, not that I've read these books, but I've read books by these authors. So The Three Musketeers by Alexandre Dumas, Sag Harbor by Colson Whitehead, The Third Man by Graham Greene, who comes up from time to time on this podcast. And Grant, I'm curious if you have your own list, you know, or books that you've read over the years that have inspired you in this space.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that when I think about a list like this, I'm not coming up with much, you know. So my list feels a little weird because while some of the novels I'm going to talk about are, you know, kind of about male friendship, none of them are just purely about male friendship in the way that it takes place in our everyday lives, which is why I like Tomas Moniz's take. You know, his novel is very directly about friendship in the way that it's lived every day. And, you know, when I was thinking about coming up with a list, I first thought of On the Road by Jack Kerouac. But while the book is definitely about two friends, but the road is this shared activity, sort of like going to war. So while the novel is about them, you know, they're developing together and influencing each other and having adventures, but it's also just about the road itself. And I thought of The Great Gatsby because Nick, you know, he's intrigued with Gatsby and they are technically friends, but Gatsby's so much of a symbol in the novel and they're more neighbors and acquaintances. And then the novel is so much more about Gatsby's love for Daisy and class and other issues. So I don't think that quite works as a male friendship novel either, but I did come up with a couple. So Lonesome Dove, you know, is set in the waning days of the Old West. And it, you know, is centered around the relationships between several retired Texas Rangers and their adventures driving a cattle herd from Texas to Montana. So again, you know, there's an activity like on the road that grounds them or directs them. And I think one thing that occurred to me is that it's interesting because YA and kids lit probably does a better job with male friendship than more grown-up novels. And I'm thinking of novels like The Outsiders and Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. Going through this and thinking about this just makes Tomas's novel stand out even more. You know, I feel like there are a lot of TV shows about friends and male friends like Seinfeld and Friends and Cheers and Will and Grace and Sex and the City and A Different World, you know, all of which were from the 80s and 90s, actually. I guess The Office was about work friends. So maybe there's, you know, more contemporary shows as well, but those are the ones I think of. And so I started to wonder, maybe there's something more cinematic about friendships, you know, that it's harder to carry them on the page, maybe. Or maybe it's just because they all live in the same apartment complex and you can show them together.
Yeah. I mean, I've always loved those kinds of shows, you know, even dating back to Three's Company. I have to say in my adult life, I've never lived with my best friends in the same apartment complex or building. But recently I did love the show Shrinking with Jason Segel and Harrison Ford. And it's about a therapist who goes off the rails a bit after his wife dies. But it really is a modern friendship show. The friends drop in all the time. You know, there's a level of interaction that the characters have with each other, you know, hiking together, stopping by for dinner, having parties. It did feel unrealistic to the point of absurdity at a couple different points, but it didn't affect how much I love the show. It's very, very feel good. And so, yeah, I think you're right. Like these kinds of dynamics, those kind of lighthearted, fun shows like Friends or Seinfeld, I think they're something that we want to live vicariously, or they're kind of fantasy versions of friendships, because I don't think that many of us actually have those kinds of friendship circles.
I haven't lived in an apartment complex with my friends either. So that's in the next lifetime, I guess. But yeah, I was thinking Brooke, that we you know, we talk a lot about community on Right Minded, of course, and we're sort of evangelists for writers developing a community of writers. But I think we should broaden that a bit, because sometimes our most important community, even for writing, actually includes non-writers. And I think we should acknowledge them or think about them. And I say this because I was just at a brunch and I met two new people, a married couple, and the husband was praising his wife's writing and urging her to write a novel. And she hadn't written a book or a story or anything. And she didn't, you know, seem to even have any aspiration to be a writer. But he was just praising her social media posts and her texts and saying how good she was with words. And just made me think about how that's where the seed is planted, you know, and someone telling us we're a good storyteller or a good writer and providing that unconditional support. And that can take myriad forms. And I hope she does end up writing a novel as a result. And I was thinking about how that's happened to me in a number of ways, you know. And in fact, the most important person in my writing life isn't a writer. So I'm going to acknowledge and call out my friend Jake, who actually introduced me to Chris Beatty, who's the founder of NaNoWriMo. And that, of course, led to me being involved with NaNoWriMo and working there for, you know, 13 years, which, of course, led to all sorts of things in my writing life, including my friendship with Ariel Eckstut and David Henry Sterry, who came up with the idea for the TV show America's Next Great Author and invited me to join them. And then Jake's father, Paul, was the person who introduced me to 100 Word Stories. And then I launched 100 Word Story, the lit journal, with my friend Lynn Mundell. So Jake is at the center of much of my writing life. And I, in fact, joke that I don't do anything alone without friends. And I can say that about the reading series I run with Jane Chabatari and Kirsten Chen and Meg Pokras. And then to this very podcast, Brooke, there's no way I would be doing this alone without you.
Oh my gosh. Same. It's funny that Mark Nepo's forthcoming book is You Don't Have to Do It Alone. Gratefully, I don't think I have to, you know, even if I wanted to. Most of the professional things I do are collaborations, you know, and I consider my co-teachers, my team, the people I work with, you know, as much as we're colleagues, also definitely my friends, because my creative work is central to the work that I do. So yes, thank goodness for our spirit of collaboration and not doing it alone, Grant, because this would be very hard to show up to every single week just by myself.
Yeah, definitely for me. And you know, I've said this before, but one of my favorite novels or novel series of all times is Alana Ferrante's Neapolitan series. And one interesting aspect of her novels is how the main character Lena measures herself and her achievements against Lila and her best friend. And I think our friendships, especially our lifetime friendships, invite in comparisons like that. But in the end, I think one definition of the best kind of friendship is one where you actually don't compete. And in fact, you feel comfortable failing or admitting your failures. And in fact, you can embarrass yourself. You don't need to put on airs or carry a shield. You're not tallying up points. You're just friends. So I'm very happy that Tomas Moniz is celebrating that type of friendship in his novel. And I look forward to talking with him more after the short break.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm excited to introduce Tomas Moniz, who is a Latinx writer living in Oakland, California. His debut novel, Big Familia, was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Debut Novel 2020 Award, a finalist for a Lambda 2020 Award for Bisexual Fiction, and a finalist for the Forward Review Indies Award. His new novel, All Friends Are Necessary, published by Algonquin Books, is available to pre-order and will be published on June 11th, 2024. And he edited the popular Rad Dad and Rad Families anthologies, and he teaches at Berkeley City College and the Antioch MFA program. Welcome, Tomas.
Hello. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us. And I want to start by talking about your history as a writer, especially because you came to writing by a different door than many. And I read that you started to write because you were a very young parent, just 20 years old, and you discovered the world of zines, including Ariel Gore's Hip Mama. And you were practicing what you called radical parenting, but you didn't see others practicing or writing about that, rather. So I was wondering if you can tell us a bit about how zines and radical parenting actually shaped you as a writer.
For me, zines was really a a way to find my voice and to find my community of people around me. Well, not even around me, just kind of in the world, because I wasn't seeing that many kind of younger parents at parks or, you know, at shows or just kind of, you know, in grocery stores talking about parenting, particularly like the kind of parenting I wanted to do, which was slightly different than the way I was parented. And I love my mom dearly and my dad dearly, but it was a different world, right? So discovering Ariel Gorzine, Hip Mama, was, you know, one of those mind-blowing moments where I was like, you can just write about what you're struggling with and share it with a community, and people will write back and kind of share their experiences. And so for me, that was the beginning of my writing career, was kind of sharing my own kind of creative nonfiction essays about how I wanted to parent with other parents who would then share their responses with me, and we would trade letters and then ultimately zines. And then that led to an anthology. And so I cut my teeth kind of really, you know, really in that kind of essay realm of like, my son's doing this kind of thing, or my daughter's like got in this situation. How do I talk about these issues with them in a way that honors them, but yet kind of gets at the issue I want to address? So that's kind of where I came to find my voice.
Well, Tomas, I want to take that a step farther and ask, because, you know, that zine world has that indie outsider spirit, which is one of the things that makes it so cool. And now you're writing novels. And so could you talk about how your fiction writing might have been influenced by that spirit and by those roots?
Yeah. Well, one of the beautiful things about like zine writing is that you can just publish when you want to publish, right? You don't, no one needs to give you permission. No one needs to like tell you when it's ready. And so I think I struggled a little bit in that first few years of transitioning, because I would write something and I'd be like, this is amazing. I'm having so much fun writing this. I'm going to make a zine. I'm going to put it out in the world. And then, you know, I'd read it like a year later and be like, I should have waited just a little bit and thought about it and developed it a little bit. So it both gave me kind of an inflated confidence that, like, you know, I can do this, which I think sometimes is really important, because rejection is such a, you know, key element in kind of particularly mainstream publishing, how many times we get rejected over and over and over again. And then suddenly, like, someone loves the same story that's rejected a million times. So it's just like, I realized it gave me a sense of like to trust myself. And I think that was crucial for me moving kind of, and I moved slowly, because I did, you know, the Rad Dad anthology. And I loved editing kind of people's writing then. And I was also, you know, as an editor, like working with people who came to writing very differently. So from academic writers to like people who never, you know, graduated high school. And we were just how to like kind of weave those voices together and honor the way they were telling their story. And then at the same time, kind of editing. And so I found myself really sensitive to those questions about voice and presence on a page. And so as I moved personally into that, finding my own voice and style and being able to learn from editors I did work with, but also stand firm on the way I wanted my story to sound or look or my sentences to work the craft of it. So yeah, both, gave me confidence, but it also sometimes set me up for, expecting different things that I didn't necessarily get right away.
Tomas, I want to shift a little bit into talking about your novel, and I think All Friends Are Necessary. It's such an interesting title. So I want to talk about that as perhaps a way to introduce the novel. And the two words that popped out for me when I first read it were the word all and the word necessary. And for one, all was interesting to me because I have so many different types of friends. So I literally paused and wondered if all of them were, in fact, were necessary. That was the word for them. And then I thought, you know, the word necessary was so interesting because it posed a question. And then, you know, necessary is kind of an ordinary word. So you weren't like, you know, doing the thing where you're making your title very, you know, lyrical or some lyrical spin on friendships, but celebrating the everyday necessariness of friendship, which is interesting. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about why you chose that title and then how it speaks to the novel.
Well, and this is just a harken back to the last question. This novel evolved from a little zine I did as well. Like I got into this argument with a couple friends of mine over drinks late night. We were listening to music, Elliot Smith, and they were all saying Elliot Smith is the worst, most depressing musician ever. And I was like, he's not. He's wonderful. So I wrote this little zine where every chapter had a lyric from Elliot Smith in the little chapter.
Cool.
And somehow the voice I created in that one became ultimately, you know, what what is all friends are necessary. And so, you know, I like to think from that origin of like sitting with friends, kind of like having fun, talking about serious things, and also talking about kind of art and life and, you know, what's beautiful and what isn't. That's kind of infused my thinking about how we can, you know, survive in the world. Because then the flip side of it is like, we were all dealing with a lot of trauma the last few years, and I dealt with some personal stuff in my family as well. So, you know, those friendships, sometimes the casual ones that you only see, you know, now and then, or you bump into at a grocery store, the ones that you really lean on daily, all of them kind of provide some kind of necessary healing or reminder of being a part of the world. And I think that was what kept me centered as I was trying to focus on this, writing this novel. Once I saw that it was a novel.
You know, we wanted to ask you about the topic of friendship, because in thinking about the books that we've read about friendship and even looking online to see like what are the most famous books about friendship, there's not a ton, and specifically not very many, about male friendships. Mm-hmm. And of course, friends and friendships hold so much conflict and drama, as much as lovers' conflict and drama. So how did you decide to focus this novel on friendship?
Well, Metal Matt was the first friend that the main character Efren had. And I wrote that first, in the first section of the book, there's a story where they kind of strip down on Ocean Beach. It's, in this case, summer solstice, and they rush into the water naked together. And I just, that for me was such a beautiful, like, fantasy of friendship that I had. And I've done similar things with my friends. So when I was, and I also wrote it like right after Trump got elected. So I just wanted joy. I just needed something, like I needed like the cleanse, like, and I just needed it. I was just coming back. I was out of the country when that happened. So I was coming back in, and I just started writing these stories about, you know, finding joy again in our lives. And I found myself writing more and more to my friendships, right? And obviously it's fiction. And so all of these friendships are, you know, imagined, but they, you know, they're connected to my own desire for that kind of intimacy and reminders that, you know, things can work out despite feeling overwhelmed by, you know, the scariness or the trauma or the kind of anxiety of living in the world right now and parenting babies, because I was doing that at the time and stuff like that. So it's really nice reminder, right, to strip naked and run into the water. That's a good thing.
Yeah, you can combine that with Elliot Smith too. You can do
exactly
both.
Right. Put on, yeah. Well, yeah. So in the novel, like, it's, I was also then, I tried, moved from Elliot Smith. Like, I was like, I want to write about like metal. I love metal. There's never any metal in a book, right? So I had some Black Sabbath and some all that kind of fun stuff in there.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. And you know what you're talking about with hope is really interesting to me as well, because, you know, one of my favorite novels about friendship is actually Alana Ferrante's Neapolitan series. And They're novels about many things, actually, but I think of them mostly as a friendship novel and grounded in the main character Lena's friendship with Lila. Mm-hmm. But that is such an intense, intense friendship, and it's rooted both in their love but also in their rivalry. So it's definitely less buoyant than yours. And in your novel, when I think of more of those scenes of you on the beach with Metal and it being more of a celebration of friendship and the support and protection that friends provide. So mm-hmm. This is going to go past the boundary of talking about your writing, but what role do friendships play in your life, and how did those friendships influence this story?
For me, at least, in the way I was leaning on friendship at the time, it was really, really important. I was, first of all, just kind of socially leaning on our writing community during that time, that tumultuous time, and, you know, Nazis are rallying in the street, and like, what's art even able to do in light of this kind of stuff? Like, how do we balance this? And, you know, the current climate we're in right now, like how do we navigate this and still find our, you know, feel like what we're doing has any kind of difference in the world. So to me, that artistic friendships were really, I love artistic friendships. I love hearing about them and reading about them and writing about them. So I transitioned my kind of dependency on my friends around me in the writing community to thinking about like how someone heals. And, you know, this character is going through the loss of a child and a loss of a relationship. And so returning home becomes, you know, vital for him. And, you know, when you return home, ideally you've got people that are there to kind of welcome you home. And, you know, his family is not around, so it's the friends that kind of step up. And to me, later on, there's, you know, the the rallying around Metal Matt when he's in a situation about, you know, being a single father and the various ways that that's going to manifest and the way his friends step up for him in that way. I just love the way, like, it all, you know, what comes around goes around. Like, sometimes you are supported and sometimes you support. And that's kind of what I wanted to try and capture.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's striking, Tomas, when you go out and look into the world of novel writing, you know, how much female friendship is treated, and you can find lots and lots of examples. And Grant and I were talking about this in the banter before you came on this, you know, like, what are the male friendship books? And of course, there are a lot. You know, I thought about and looked up some, including like The Three Musketeers by Alexandre Dumas, Sag Harbor by Colson Whitehead, The Third Man by Graham Greene. Jack Kerouac is on some of those lists, you know, but it's not, it just kind of struck me about the culture, you know, and how male friendship is treated in the culture, and that if there were more novels about male friendships, that, you know, there would be more of a celebration perhaps, you know, and I wondered how you thought about that, you know, almost from like a social context, and speaking to what you said before, you know, that you wrote this when Trump was president, you know, how important male friendships are to men, but also how isolated men can be.
Right. And well, I appreciate you bringing that up, because it is something I want to be careful with that, because also, like, you know, for example, when I was doing the rad dad stuff, like, just because a father, like, you know, changed the diaper or took care of the child, that doesn't make you kind of like a rad dad, right? My notion of kind of radical parenting was the difficult kind. That was the line I always used, the kind of the conscientious kind of parenting. And so, you know, I had to navigate a lot of, like, people, like, there's a lot of nuance that gets lost in that kind of stuff. And I wanted in Rad Dad to keep that nuance there. And so with this book, I think the same type of thing, like, you know, men do need relationships with other men to hold each other both accountable to, like, we are the ones responsible in some ways for patriarchy. And that's not a nuanced sentence right there, but, like, we have a responsibility for, like, how we participate in that and like recognize that. And then, you know, how we engage with each other around those issues. And so I think that's in some ways what I was trying to kind of explore with these relationships, particularly with Metal Matt and Efren, like how we kind of can support each other to be better people, let alone better men.
That's so great, because so often men's friendships get a little toxic in terms of whatever, the competitiveness and many other things.
Sure.
Well, I'm curious because, you know, obviously you've drawn a lot from life and brought it into your writing, whether it's parenting or friendship. And I'm always curious about the reciprocal relationship with that. Like, how has writing about parenthood and writing about friendships actually changed the way that you carry out both of those?
Well, yeah, I mean, this has been my default response with, like, I'm a better parent and a better person after working with, like, all the voices that I did with Rad Dad and Rad Families, like trans fathers and queer fathers and fathers of color and poor fathers. Like, and, you know, it helped me even evolve the project itself from Rad Dad to kind of Rad Families, because I realized dad was kind of a problematic term in the first place. And so how to unpack that. And so, like, I really benefited from, you know, the stories that other people, you know, shared. And I think that's partly why I was so proud of that project. And, you know, the same thing with this one, like sharing my writing with my writing group, like, in thinking about the ways I want to move through the world with my friendships has required me to try and do some of that in my real life, to take some responsibility. I have a big family. And so how I, you know, want to handle those relationships and, you know, repair relationships from past decades of living together and avoiding difficult topics. And this kind of reminds me that those are the conversations I want to have.
Yeah, that's so great. And, you know, in closing, I want to say that on your author website and your bio page, and I saw this in other places on the internet as well, is that you invite people to write you, and that you promise to write back if a return address is included. So I just want to point that out to people, that they should write you, and that you find you can find the information on your website. But it's Tomas Moniz, P.O. Box 3555, Berkeley, California, 94703. So you're a friend to the world.
I am. It's been great. I just got a letter today from, like, some person in, and I think it was like Indianapolis, who checked out Big Familia from the library and was like, your character reminds me of my son. And I was just like, oh, well, thank you. Right.
That's so sweet.
It really is.
The only problem is hopefully you don't get so many letters that you don't feel burdened to write everybody back, because that's a big task the more famous you get.
Oh, right. Well, postcards are wonderful because, like, you can just, like, you know, but sadly, it's like I feel like I get a lot of letters, but even in the scope of it, it's not that many. It's so random. Like, there'll be three letters that come in 1 week, and then I'll go 2 months where not a thing comes, and then suddenly, so I don't know how, something's going on in the universe. I trust the universe. So there we go.
Well, I hope this novel is so big and so many of our listeners pre-order it right now and start writing Tomas letters that you get overwhelmed with postcards and letters.
I'll blame you all. I'll come back on and be like, look, you need to help me.
Oh, thanks, Tomas, and good luck with the book.
All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
We'll be right back after this short break with today's book trend.
So, Brooke, in thinking about this week's book trend, I realized that I've actually been living in a trend for years. And the odd thing about living in a trend is that you forget that it's a trend because it's your life. And the trend that I'm talking about is flash fiction. Ever since I began writing and publishing flash fiction, and ever since I launched the Lit Journal 100-word story with my friend Lynn Mundell, I've been asked, why is flash fiction growing in popularity? And I don't have a great answer for that, but when we launched 100 Word Story in 2011, I swear there were only 20 or 30 flash fiction journals, if that. And now I think there are easily 200 or 300 or maybe 2,000 or 3,000. I honestly can't keep track of them. They sprout up every day.
It's really interesting when something suddenly blooms into such a powerful trend in this way. You know, it clearly speaks to a zeitgeist kind of movement. And I know with indie publishing, like for me, I had that experience as well, you know, kind of being on the crest of a movement in publishing, you know, that it's like it felt like there was nothing. And then all of a sudden there was something really big. And, you know, I'll just hazard a guess to say that the internet is probably responsible for this kind of growth.
We can pretty much blame the internet for everything. I always try to think of reasons that go beyond the internet, but that, you know, obviously the internet plays a role, especially in this. You know, flash fiction began to be popularized in the U.S. With a number of anthologies back in the 80s and 90s. So I think that set the stage for things, you know, and I think because of that, I've noticed that the form is especially popular with younger writers, you know, in part because they've been taught it in school and it's been more prominently part of their writing lives. But the internet definitely opened the floodgates. And that's in part because if you think about the traditional literary journal, you know, it's a print product, and a print journal can better accommodate a short story that is 8 or 10,000 words long. And once you go online, though, you know, shorter stories work better. So I think traditional lit journals that are online, you know, got more interested in flash, or when they went online or started online. And for example, even like, you know, I'm thinking about Tin House, which is no longer with us, but it even used to dedicate Fridays to a flash story, you know, and then journals like 100 Word Story sprouted up. So a whole new era of journals was ushered in relatively recently.
Yeah. And one thing I'll note too is the shareability of these shorter stories. You know, listeners who might not know, although we've talked about it in the past, flash fiction is defined as under 1,000 words. And then there's microfiction, which is stories under 400 words, like 100 word stories. They're perfect to share because a reader can like just read them literally in one sitting, kind of like a post. And I find for myself, like it can be very daunting when someone sends me something, you know, I read like The Atlantic, for instance, and I got sucked into a story the other day that was probably like 15,000 words and took me an hour or more to read. So there is something very compelling about these shorter works and how much people read them and how they reach people.
Yeah, they definitely fit into online reading behavior better than longer fiction. And that said, I always say that the shorter the piece, the more attention it deserves, because, you know, some of these stories can be as packed and nuanced as a poem. Still, you know, they just fit better on the internet. And I just finished judging the annual Best Microfiction Anthology. So I read couple hundred stories. And I have to say, I was so heartened by the level of creativity and experimentation that I read. And that's one reason I think the form is becoming more popular. You know, it's a new terrain, a new land, and writers feel more free to experiment and push the boundaries as a result.
And I know that these kinds of stories can take a long time to revise and to get right, Grant, but I do think the short term can invite more creativity because there's less to lose. Because like if a 300 word experiment doesn't work out, it's a little different than a 300 page novel not working out, right?
Yeah, good point, Brooke. You know, I can agree with that because I have experimented with a 300 page novel that didn't work out. So I don't want to do that again. And as a side note, though, I do want to attribute the flash fiction community for the forum's growth as well, because, you know, I've wondered about this, but I think perhaps because it's all kind of new and there isn't the same kind of status or commercial opportunity or hierarchy that's embedded in so many other forums, that I find the flash community just kind of it's more welcoming and supportive and accessible. And I see the most, you know, revered flash fiction authors, you know, out there online, you know, rooting others on. So it's just a really refreshing community. I think that's part of the reason for its growth as well.
Well, and I love that, Grant, because that's our ethos here on Right Minded. Of course, we are rooting other people on. We come from this indie space, which clearly is the same spirit as this flash fiction space. And so we hope that we are welcoming and supportive and accessible. Thank you all so much for listening to us. We are here every week. We'll be back next week. Keep writing, write on, stay right minded.